Before the episode starts, Dan and I wanted to let you guys know that we'll be participating in the video game 24-hour marathon charity event known as Extra Life this year.
Yeah, so we'll have more details coming up, but look for that on November 7th. Yep. Join in for some live streaming, maybe some prizes. We'll have more details in the weeks to come leading up to the event.
Hey everybody, Brian Collins here with another exciting episode of the Pixel Hub Podcast. And man, we got an exciting show for you today. But first, we're going to check in with my buddy Dan, see how he's doing. Buddy, how are you doing?
I'm doing really good. And as you said, exciting show today.
Oh man, we've got Jorge Gutierrez, the director of the animated feature, award-winning animated feature, The Book of Life. And if you haven't seen that movie, you need to go out right now and buy it. Stop what you're doing.
It's been out for almost a whole year. This week, right?
Almost exactly a year. This Saturday, right? Yeah. It will be the one-year anniversary.
No excuse. Go watch it now.
It is a great one. And we caught up with Jorge Gutierrez first at SIGGRAPH this year, where we got to hear him and some of the people that at Real Effects there who were working on the film, some of the supervisors, technical directors, on a panel discussing it. And Jorge's he didn't go as much into the technical side, but he did have some really, really great stories about the making of it and how it was a movie that almost wasn't made.
It almost never came to be. Mm-hmm. Some of those stories, and I hope we have a chance to actually hear those stories again because they were great. And so being able to not only hear them again ourselves, but also kind of share them with our listeners, it's...
Yeah, they were really inspirational.
Very inspirational.
As well as being funny and entertaining, they were really inspirational because, this was a story that took him a long time to get.
It's like a lifetime project for him. Yeah,
it was. And, the movie ended up being about $50 million budget, right, which is not very expensive.
It's nothing as far as today's animated feature films,
And to try and get that made, get his vision, which was really... it was really like out there to a lot of producers, a lot of studios who were going, you want to make this for $50 million?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
The Day of the Dead?
Yeah.
Like, what? Yeah.
He had to do a lot of hustling and convincing and some hilarious things that he's hopefully going to talk about. We'll try and get into. But we'll go ahead and talk to Jorge about it, and we hope you guys enjoy it. But first, a word from our sponsor. As any motion capture actor will tell you, working on a green screen set all day long can be grueling work. Whether you're swinging from a tree like a 500-pound gorilla or power sliding past strafing bullet fire, motion capture can be a real wear and tear on your equipment. It's at these moments when accuracy matters the most, and missing or hanging mocap balls just aren't an option.
That's why the pros only choose the best ping pong ball adhesive around. Magic Mike's mocap ball glue is an industrial strength chemical adherent made from a combination of black rhino tusk and 100% American bald eagle claw. Magic Mike's ball glue gives you the confidence and peace of mind you'll need to make those flesh-eating velociraptors come to life.
Stick to Magic Mike's glue and your balls will stick to you. With asking you about how important was animation to you growing up as a kid in Mexico?
I was kind of obsessed with it. The first movie I saw in a movie theater was Pinocchio with my dad. And my little brain exploded. I must have been 5 years old. And I was terrified and I cried and I laughed. And afterwards, people talk about events and life changing you. I was shaken to the core. I at that point, I was like, I don't know what that was, but I want to live in that universe. That's kind of what my dad says. I said afterwards, and so I by that point, I was drawing all the time. I was kind of like a trained monkey for the family. In that, at parties, they would like hold me from my legs upside down and have me draw, or they like give me tequila when I was 6 years old and try to have me draw drawing. So drawing became like the thing. Like my grandfather would slap me in the face and see if I could keep drawing as he was slapping me. This is a traditional Mexican upbringing. But that's kind of when I fell in love with cartoons. And then, you know, eventually as I grew up, anime, for some reason in Mexico, but I guess the licensing is so cheap, we had lots of anime. Mm-hmm. So I saw, you know, Popeyes and Tom and Jerry's and all this stuff coming from the U.S., but I was also watching lots of Japanese stuff. Mm-hmm. And so eventually, you know, I kind of decided this is it. This is the thing I want to do. And everybody laughed at me in Mexico. You know? Yeah. It was like saying you want to be an astronaut mm-hmm. To actually make cartoons. But that was, you know, it all started from Pinocchio.
Well, I wanted to get into the Book of Life and really how that was inspired, or, you know, where that came from. Because I remember when you were talking at SIGGRAPH, you talked about the Day of the Dead and, you know, the myth behind that and how that sort of began when you were young and ended up with you wanting to make this movie. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I have always felt is whenever I, you know, see a movie or read a book or listen to an album mm-hmm. that I really, really love, usually the first book or movie or album that bands make is very much based on events of their youth and mm-hmm. things that happened in their life. And so I was very marked by something that happened to me. And so Book of Life was inspired by an event that happened to me in Mexico City when I was 9 years old. My best friend passed away. His name was Mauricio. And I took it. I wasn't sad. I was just really angry. Hmm. And I was really angry at the world and really sort of, I didn't think it was fair that he had to go. Obviously, it affected me in school and affected me with my parents. And so my mom sat me down. And at that point in Mexico, you know, this is like probably mid-80s, yeah. early mid-80s, Halloween was becoming very popular in Mexico. Hmm. And then how could it not, right? You go to strangers' houses and they give you a free candy. Right. Like, no Mexican kid, that sounded like the greatest thing on earth. You know, my mom sat me down and she said, I'm going to tell you about Day of the Dead. Even though we don't practice it, I want you to start practicing it. And she said, on November 2nd, those who are no longer here come to visit us. But they come to visit us if we keep them with us. And she said, your friend Mauricio, he's here right now. And I would say, but where? You obviously, mom, he's dead. He's not here. She said, no, the fact that we're talking about him, that means he's here. Hmm. So from now on, always talk about him. You know, on your birthday, invite him. On Christmas, buy him a present. November 2nd, we're going to talk about him. We're going to sing songs that you two like. Go watch the movies that you liked watching with him. And just by doing that, you will keep his memory with us. And she said, that's Day of the Dead. Basically, the idea is, as long as we talk about those who are no longer with us, as long as we tell their stories, as long as we sing their songs, we cook their favorite dishes, mm-hmm. we tell their favorite jokes, we have them with us. The moment we don't say their names, mm-hmm. the moment we don't talk about them, the moment we forget them, then they really are dead. And that is a very, very Mexican thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, in my opinion, a very universal idea.
Okay.
And as you guys know, Western culture, death is seen as something we don't talk about. People basically get really upset and really sad, and they kind of don't want to even think about it.
Yeah.
In Mexico, because of our history, we have this sort of innate relationship with death. And it's a constant reminder that we need to live life, mm-hmm. right? There's a Mexican poet, Octavio Paz, that says, every Mexican has a beautiful lady next to us with death whispering in our ear, live, live, right? She's so jealous that we get to live. So it's Day of the Dead is a celebration of living and a celebration of those who are no longer here. So as I grew up, that's what I did. You know, every year I celebrated my friend Mauricio, and as other relatives passed away, I sort of celebrated them. And eventually, when I was 18, I met the girl of my dreams, who I ended up marrying, Sandra. And Sandra, after 2 weeks of having met her, I proposed, right? I was so in love. I was 18. So like a smart girl, she said no. And you know, we started going out, and then I realized I need to propose on Day of the Dead. I need to do it on November 2nd, and Mauricio, my friend, will be there, and he'll back me up. And of course, she's going to say yes. So sure enough, Day of the Dead comes around, and that's what I did. And so what you see in Book of Life, Manolo proposing with a trail of candles. I can't play the guitar, so I had to hire a trio to play for me. That's how I proposed to her. And even the way I proposed, you know, I didn't have enough money for a ring. Basically, all that dialogue is what I said to her. And so she said yes. And then after that, you know, I said, I want my friend Mauricio to be the best man at my wedding. And so we have to get married on Day of the Dead. We're going to have a big Day of the Dead wedding. And I'm going to invite everybody who's here, and everybody who's not here to show up. And I want all our ancestors to be there and see this union of these two families. So no priest wanted to do that. You know, Mexico's kind of traditional about stuff like that. Until we ended up going to some big, high, mighty priest who said, I'm not going to marry you on that day, but I want to hear why you want to get married on that day. And I told him the story. And he teared up and he said, I will absolutely marry you on that day. And so we had an amazing day at that wedding, just like Book of Life. And I got so drunk that I swear all my favorite wrestlers showed up and all my friends who, you know, had passed away were there partying with us. And we had a fantastic time. So after that, I said, well, now I want to give Day of the Dead to all the kids all over the world. I want to give them this idea, this message that obviously I didn't come up with, but that has helped me throughout my life. And honestly, kids deal with death way sooner than their parents are ready because of the math of life, right? Grandparents usually tend to pass away. And so every kid is dealing with stuff like this, whether their parents want to or not. And so that kind of became my mission for the movie. I wanted to honor my friend and I wanted to honor my culture, but I also wanted to take the stigma away from something that's very natural and have it be a positive thing for people to talk about those who are no longer with us.
Now, when you told the story to the pastor who was going to do your wedding and you convinced him to do the wedding on that day, was that the moment where you're like, oh, I can tell this story and have it be influential and have it, where you see the power in that story?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things I learned. People connect, especially for someone like me who has to basically convince, right? As a director, I'm constantly trying to convince actors and musicians and studio executives to let me make something with their money or collaborate with them with their talent. My only weapon is basically storytelling. And so I tell them, this is what happened to me. Help me tell this to the rest of the world. Help me tell the story with me, or enable me to tell this story. So storytelling and sort of this tradition of passing what's occurred to me to someone else is my only strength. As a professional storyteller, I see the power of that. I'm kind of addicted to stories. Like, I love talking to older people because they have the great, great stories and they have all these experiences that they've gone through. And they're dying to tell these stories and no one wants to listen. So I'm kind of a senior citizen junkie in that I love hearing tales from the past. But yeah, the power of storytelling is universal, as you guys know.
Yeah, and getting the Book of Life made, you had to tell some stories, didn't you?
Oh yeah. I mean, I could write a book about just the craziness of making the Book of Life. So, you know, this is the short route. So when I graduated from film school, I had made a short very much inspired by Day of the Dead. All the characters were wooden puppets because of Pinocchio. And I also love stop motion. So it was my love letter to those three things. And this idea that folk art is made by artists, which are basically the artists of the people, right? And folk art is art that's supposed to reflect who we are and reflect our pure nature. And so that was the inspiration for the wooden dolls. So I immediately after I finished my short, it did really well. It won a bunch of festivals. I got to go to the Cannes Film Festival to show it there. Won a student Emmy. So at that point, a guy named Aaron Berger, who I'm still with, signed me up to represent me. And he said, as good as your short is, there's nothing I can do with this except get you meetings. But if you write a feature based on your short, maybe we could sell that. So I, you know, young and full of hope, I bought a How to Write a Screenplay book in 21 days because in animation, they didn't really teach you script writing. And I wrote an outline for Book of Life. And so sure enough, he sent me to every studio in town, Disney and DreamWorks and Sony, Warner Brothers. I pretty much went everywhere. And everybody told me the same thing. They're very nice and very polite, but they said, your idea is too weird. And no one wants to see a movie about this weird holiday about dead Mexicans. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we are looking for funny talking animal movies, and this does not fit that. And by the way, you're just a dumb kid out of school. So there's no way we're going to let you direct the movie. And so I listened to them. And I said, well, you guys probably know better than I do. So I put my idea away. And, you know, I started working throughout my career first I had a little web show, and then I started working in television for a while. Then my wife and I had a TV show on Nickelodeon called El Tigre, The Adventures of Manny Rivera. After that show started doing really well, you know, it won 7 Emmys in 1 year, which is kind of a big deal. The feature animation phone call started again, and one of the studios that called me was DreamWorks. And so I began working on Book of Life at night while I was working on El Tigre during the day at Nickelodeon. And so we developed Book of Life over there for a while. And then in classic Hollywood fashion, there were creative differences as to what the type of movie the studio wanted to make and the type of movie that I wanted to make. And so depending on who you ask, I quit. I decided I didn't want to be a part of the version of the movie that they were trying to make. And so the movie fell apart, and Jeffrey Katzenberg was very, very, very kind to me and said, I'm going to give you all your rights back. I swear to you, this is something that means the world to you, and I want you to be able to come back, which I will thank him forever. So I got my rights back. So I had just quit at DreamWorks. El Tigre gets canceled at Nickelodeon, and my wife tells me she's pregnant.
Nice.
So I was unemployed. I just quit, you know, a $200 million movie. Our dream TV show had just been killed. So I remember running out of my apartment and yelling to the heavens, is that all you got? Bring it. So after that, I started pitching like crazy, you know, because I knew a baby was coming. And sure enough, out of nowhere, the studio in Dallas named Real Effects, who at that point had never made a movie, said, hey, we heard about your movie. We don't have $200 million, but we can do a $50 million version of your movie. And the only thing we need is you to move to Dallas. So at that point, I realized, hey, I moved out of Mexico to make Mexican cartoons. I can move out of LA to make a Hollywood movie.
Right.
And so we threw caution to the wind, and my wife and I moved over here. We worked on the film, you know, writing with my co-writer, Doug Lindell. At that point, I hired Paul Sullivan to be an art director and Simon Varela to be a production designer. And my wife, Sandra, designs all the female characters. I design all the male characters. Mm-hmm. And so we just put together a giant pitch presentation because Real Effects needs a co-financer and a distributor. Mm-hmm. So all this work we were doing, we were basically making it to woo another studio to help us. At that point, they said, you need a big name producer to help you with this. You know, back then, other movies were announcing that Tim Burton was producing blah, 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 basically shepherding these young directors. So like all Mexican film nerds, I said, I want Guillermo del Toro. Guillermo del Toro is my hero. I yelled, Guillermo del Toro, at the top of my lungs. And I would like to believe that somewhere in Canada, and he said, someone needs me.
So, like a bat signal.
yeah. Whoa. Someone just called me. So sure enough, at that point, Guillermo was directing The Hobbit. Obviously, as we all know, things didn't quite work out. And so he moved back to L.A. But when that happened, he was, you know, the prettiest girl in town. And so he was getting offers left and right. And here we were, this tiny little movie. And so he turned me down constantly. He ended up turning me down 15 times. And there were times where he would agree to a pitch. Yeah. And as we were walking into a studio, he would cancel. I mean, I flew from Mexico to pitch him during Christmas. I mean, he canceled so many times. And all the producers on this side kept saying, you know, he's just telling you he's not interested. And like a stubborn Mexican donkey, I just kept at it. And so now he tells me that he got fed up. He's like, this kid, he won't quit. Bring him to my house so I can say no to him to his face. And so sure enough, we go to his house. We have all this artwork, all these maquettes, and we walk in there. He did not look happy. It was almost like he was annoyed. Mm-hmm. So we walk in there, and he's a huge animation fan. So if you guys see the Kronos Blu-ray, the Criterion one, he gives a tour of his bleak house because he has a house where he lives with his two daughters and his wife. But he also has a house, which is called Bleak House, where it's all his memorabilia, animation stuff. He's a huge collector, so he has like original Mary Blair's and Ivan Earls and, you know, Edward Gorey stuff. Just it's incredible. And so as soon as we walk in, we go, we can't pitch here. There's too much stuff. Our stuff is going to look like crap compared to all this. So someone makes a decision, hey, you should pitch him outside. You know, Guillermo's a big guy and I'm a big guy. And as soon as we walk outside, it's like 110 degrees, August in LA. So he starts sweating. I start sweating. We set up all the stuff. They had told me, you have 20 minutes to pitch them. First, they told me 30. Then as soon as we walk in there, they go, you have 20. And so we go outside, we set up all this stuff. I'm super nervous. You know, I open my mouth, you know, I summon my ancestors to help me on this journey. And I, as soon as I start opening my mouth, Guillermo, which at this point calls me Gordo, which basically means the fat guy. He says, Gordo, you have 5 minutes. So he's cut my 20 minutes down to 5. So I'm like, okay, ancestors, help me. I open my mouth again, and I kid you not, there must have been, I don't know, like 5 leaf blower guys with lawnmowers. And it was almost like they were waiting. As soon as I opened my mouth, this like wave of noise hits us, right? Like, and I yell at Guillermo, do I wait? And he goes, Gordo, bitch, now. So as those guys are blowing, you know, the loudest sounds I've ever heard in my life, I'm yelling my heart out. And it's a horrendous pitch. You know, the movie is a very tender movie. So imagine this guy sweating and just yelling. And then Maria gets down on one knee. I'm going to propose. Like, I'm running out of breath. I'm almost falling in the pool. It's a disaster. Guillermo's laughing, but he's obviously not laughing with me. He's laughing at me. The pitch finishes. And all the people there, you know, the producers and the assistants, everybody's just looking at the floor like they just saw the worst car crash. Yeah, it was like, come with me. So I go walk into his living room, and I sit down, and I'm devastated, right? I realize I really screwed the pooch. This is a disaster. And so I looked at him with puppy eyes, like, Maestro, give me some hope before I leave so I don't, you know, go outside and kill myself. And I go, Guillermo, I'm so sorry. I know that was a terrible pitch. And he goes, Gordo, terrible pitch. That was the shittiest pitch I've ever seen. So I stand up to shake his hand and just, you know, just get out of there. And he goes, Gordo, sit down. So I sit back down and he goes, I know who you are. I have 2 daughters. Every Saturday morning, we would watch your cartoon on TV. I know your sense of humor. I know your art. I know your love of the culture. I know how you see Mexico. Of course I want to produce your movie. So I was like, ah! I stood up and, you know, I hugged him. And he was wet and I was wet. So it was like, her DNA's merged. And I was so sweaty that, honestly, I really believe I peed my pants. So he goes, hey, Gordo, you better have written that script. If you didn't write that script, you're not a real director. I said, oh, I co-wrote the script with, you know, Doug Langdell, the head writer on El Tigre. So I run to my car and I open the trunk and I had gone to a wedding. And sure enough, at that wedding, they gave us, as a parting gift, a bottle of tequila. Well, the bottle of tequila broke. And so my script, basically the tequila had drowned it and it had dried up. So it was all crinkly, like it looked gross. So I was like, oh no. I was like, oh, screw it. So I grabbed it and I ran back and, you know, blowing on it, trying to get it to be less wet. And I hand it to him. He looks at it, you know, he examines it, and he smells it. And he goes, this is a good script. And that was it. That's how it started.
That's awesome.
Wow. So what really helped motivate you through all of that rejection? I mean, most people would get rejected that many times. They just wouldn't keep going back.
You know, it's kind of been my whole career. It's one of those things where if people tell me you can't do this, I always ask why, right? I'm the guy in the pitches that when they're told we don't like your idea, I go, I totally get it, but why? Like, give me the reasons why. And if I hear, because it's never been done, then I know. Okay, then it's a no for the right reason.
Right.
If it's, we can't do this because we have this exact movie in development, and you know, then that's just luck. But I'm that guy. And so when I would hear, well, Guillermo's canceling, I would try to find out why. Oh, because he gets pitched a lot of the Day of the Dead movies, and he thinks they're all crap. Or because he's so busy that he keeps getting offered stuff, and you are frankly, you know, at the bottom of the pile. When I find out why there's a no, I try to figure out, okay, then I'll keep trying. You know, he has something I want, which is him. I have nothing he wants. So of course I'm going to keep trying. And I've always been really motivated by people telling me, you can't do this. It kind of fuels my fire.
I'm really interested when I watch the Book of Life and I hear your story about where you grew up and the popular culture that you watched, how it sort of manifests itself in the Book of Life in various ways, from like references to, say, Warner Brothers cartoons or different styles of cartoons or the humor to things like contemporary songs, right? Because this is the movie also has, it's kind of a musical. And you used quite a few songs that a lot of people would recognize. What was that like scoring the movie and getting those songs?
Well, you know, one of the things in the movie, it's very much inspired by Orpheus, right? The myth of Orpheus, yeah. Going to the underworld. And Orpheus was a musician. And so the movie, we knew his weapon will be love. And the best way for him to sort of express himself will be songs. But I didn't want it to be a musical. And so when you watch the movie, the moments where people sing are real moments where people could sing in real life. Like, the villain doesn't break into song like, I'm gonna kill all you. Like, that doesn't happen. But if your hero wants to sing for a living, then of course it makes sense. In the beginning, when the decision for the music happened, honestly, I just put all those songs in the script thinking lawyers will not let me have them in there. And I had to pick songs that would make sense for our characters to sing. Of course, I'm a huge music fan. And I grew up on the border. I grew up in Tijuana, which is, you know, the last corner of Latin America. So I was listening to music from the US and the UK, but also listening to Mexican music. And my favorite thing was when those two things would meld, you know, when mariachi bands would play Metallica, or when I would hear, techno mariachi music, like sort of the mix of the two was my favorite stuff. And so when I was writing those songs in, I just assumed, well, at some point, someone's going to tell me you can't have any of this. And at some point, we're going to have to write original songs for all these moments. And so I just stuck those songs in there, and I would describe, you know, Creep. This is a bolero version of Creep. And I was just nerding out sort of as a music geek and a film geek. And when Guillermo read all that stuff, he was like, I love that idea. I love that you're mixing American songs and UK songs. And, you know, I even put, you know, lots of traditional Mexican music is in the film, but also lots of classical music and you know, a little opera here and there, hip hop, like basically all the stuff I love. And so he said, okay, this is very interesting. Why are you putting all that stuff in? And I basically tell them, if I use traditional Mexican songs, they're all in Spanish, so no one will understand them. And I love Moulin Rouge. I love movies that basically acknowledge that there's music from different eras playing. Yeah. And you know, I love spaghetti westerns. Ennio Morricone is my favorite film composer. All his scores have electric guitars in the Old West. I love Quentin Tarantino, and I love Wes Anderson, and that's what they do, right? They use music from different eras and put them in their films. I said, why can't we do that with animation? All these other guys get to do it. Why can't I? And so again, not knowing, being told you can't do this stuff, I would ask why, and they'd say, well, because no one's done it. And so that's kind of what I did. The first song, the one that changed everything, was Creep by Radiohead. That one, everybody told me, including Guillermo, you will never get that song. I tried to get it for Hellboy, and Radiohead said no. They have never licensed that song for a movie. There's no way in hell you're going to get that song. Fox Music told me, you'll never get that song, and Radiohead doesn't like that song because it's a song that sort of reminds them when they were thought of as a one-hit wonder. And so they don't even play it in concerts. It's a really touchy song for them. So, again, everybody's saying no. I said, okay, well, I want to get a no from the band so I can frame that email that says we can't get Creep. So that became sort of my goal. I just want to get an email from the band saying no. So we cut a sequence with storyboards to an acoustic performance that Tom York did. And then I just wrote him a letter explaining, here's what the movie's about. Here's what that song means to me. You know, as a kid, I identified with that song as an artist, feeling like I didn't fit in. I also heard in Mexico City, a band of mariachis. I was in a cantina, and the youngest guy in the mariachi band was this 15-year-old kid, and he started playing Creep acoustic by himself without anyone asking him. He could barely speak English, but he sang his heart out. And by the time the song ended, the cantina was silent. And then it erupted with cheers. But it was one of those moments that I thought, here's this song from the UK that a kid in Mexico City made his own and used it to express his frustration of, I don't want to be a mariachi. What the hell am I doing here? Mm-hmm. And so I told them that story, again, the power of storytelling. And sure enough, they said, we're going to give you the song because this is absolutely what that song is about. Hmm. And you are using it for very, very noble reasons. And not only are we going to let you use the song, but we're going to let you use the song at a very sort of indie movie cost. And so after that, anytime a band would ask us for a ton of money, well, first of all, everybody found out we were using Creep. Lots of bands were now very interested in giving us songs. But then when they would ask us for a ton of money, we would say, wait, Radiohead gave us Creep for this much. Are you saying you're better than Radiohead? So the power of guilt allowed us to get lots and lots of songs. And we basically got every song in that original script. It's kind of crazy.
Huh. Now, you said there once you got Creep, then a lot of other bands were opening up to that. Were there any others that maybe you were offered that you thought might have been better than the original pick?
We got to the point where bands were giving us original songs. Hmm. And, you know, the studio would say, you should write a sequence around that song since that band is offering that song. And again, it was one of those things where I said, the story is driving the story. We can't make the movie about X band giving us their song because they're a hot band right now. Right. And so it was very hard to navigate that stuff because at some point, someone in the studio is going, whoa, this Grammy winning band just offered you an original song. Yeah, but it has nothing to do with that moment in the movie. Well, rewrite that moment so the song works. So it was kind of dangerous, but it all ended up working out. I mean, there were certain bands that, for example, I really wanted to get a Pink Floyd song in the movie, and those guys don't get along. So so that one I knew, like, there's no letter I can write to them where they'll give me the rights to it.
Now, it seems like there was a story you told about how you wrote an email. And you actually had a mariachi band playing the song at some point.
Oh, yeah. So this is the famous or infamous Mumford & Sons.
Yeah, that's what it was, Mumford & Sons.
Mumford & Sons story. So we had, you know, a big moment in the movie. It's a growing up montage. You know, I love Disney movies from the 90s. I said, you know, our movie is kind of a deconstruction of that type of storytelling. We have to have a growing up montage. And what better song than I Will Wait? You know, I love Mumford & Sons. But I kind of like those songs before the band was nominated for a Grammy. And that became, you know, the song of the year. Mm-hmm. So when we put it in the movie, I thought, well, of course they're going to give it to us. They love Radiohead. You know, they love Gustavo Santaolalla, our composer. I bet it's not going to be so hard to get the song. Well, we meet with the manager and we play him the sequence in the movie. And he goes, I love your movie, man, but the band is not going to be happy because I Will Wait is not a love song. It's a song about faith. Mm. And the band is really upset that everybody thinks it's a love song when it's not. So just know that they're going to say no, but I'm going to take them all the stuff you gave me. I'm going to show them the sequence you gave me, and I'll get an answer. So goes to the band, shows them all the stuff, comes back, and he says, the band loves your movie. But you cannot use that song because of the exact reason I gave. But the band liked your song, your movie so much, they're going to give you an original song that hasn't been released. Mm-hmm. So everybody freaks out. Everybody at the studio freaks out. We listen to the song and it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's the most beautiful song, but it's the wrong song for that moment. So again, studio goes, are you insane? You rewrite your movie to make that song work. So again, being the dumb passionate guy that I am, I said, well, I don't want to do that because that's not what the movie's about. This song works really well. I want to give it one last try. So we hire a mariachi band, and there's one of these days this thing is going to pop up somewhere. There's an iPhone video of one of the producers shooting me, and I basically beg the band, right? And I tell them, guys, as an artist, from artist to artist, you know, I believe that when you put something out into the world, people make it their own. And so even though this song is not about love and it's about faith, I interpret it as a love song. And in our movie, that's how our characters interpreted the song, and the words fit perfectly, and the sentiment and the emotion, and more than anything, the heart is so great and so universal. That moment is perfect. And then I said, and if you love the children of Mexico, you will let us use your song. And as soon as I say that, a mariachi band pops up from behind me and starts playing I Will Wait, mariachi style. So we send the video to the manager. The manager sends it to the band, and, you know, goes through all the proper channels, all the proper producers, blah, 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 blah. And I get an email. We love the children of Mexico, you son of a bitch. You can have our song.
So do you use that so now that, for others?
So imagine that pretty much happened with lots of the songs.
I just imagine every time someone tells you no, you sort of transform into this donkey that won't move.
Yeah, I mean, my wife says I get crazy eyes when people say no. But like, it's almost like you enjoy it more.
Right. Did they ever release that first original song?
You know what? They have not.
Wow.
Huh.
Because, man, I'd like to hear it. That would be pretty awesome. So, you know, Book of Life is a very symbolic movie. There's lots of symbols in it. What to you is the power of symbols for storytelling?
Well, you know, as a Mexican, we are surrounded by symbols, right? Mm-hmm. Not only from the Catholic mix of Aztec and Mayan, but just in our culture altogether, there's symbols everywhere. Everything has a symbol. I mean, God damn it, our flag has an eagle killing a snake on the flag. It's the only flag in the world where someone's killing something.
Is that true?
So, yeah, just, right? We are surrounded by symbols. And so all those symbols mean a lot. And so if you use them properly, I think they can be really, really powerful. The type of art I like is full of symbolism. And my favorite movies are just dripping with symbolism. And so that was my, you know, my thing with Book of Life. I said, this might be the only movie I ever get to make. And some directors would slap me in the face for saying this, but I really believe movies live on video now. You know, the amount of times people can watch them on the big screen is limited, but they exist forever on video. So from day one, Book of Life was conceived and sort of born with this idea that it should be a movie that you can watch 100 times, and every time you're going to find different things, and you're going to start finding different symbols and guesses that you know, the movie's going to tell you stuff before it happens. It's full of little references to other things. Lines in the movie are repeated lines from other movies. I mean, the movie's full of quotes from all my favorite movies. Princess Bride is one of my favorite movies, so there's a reference to that. When I was a kid, I thought MC Hammer was really cool. And now I think he's really weird. So all the Channing Tatum Joaquin lines are all MC Hammer song titles.
Are you serious?
I'm going to have to watch it again.
So it's little stuff like that.
When he says and, stop, you know, the, hammer time.
Yeah. I mean, literally, Joaquin goes, it's Joaquin time. You know, hammer time. So there's a lot of that stuff. And then, you know, the symbolism of burning heart, which means passion. Joaquin is basically the moon. Manolo is basically the sun. Maria wears a red skirt, which is what the bullfighters use for bullfighting. I mean, the movie's just, if you ever get the art of book, all the secrets are in there.
Yeah, I think we actually have that. Yeah. All of this, like, obviously the Book of Life is, it's a passion project for you that started since your childhood. Now that it's done, do you almost feel like tapped out, or do you find almost also with, you know, finding motivation and getting rejected, and now that you've, you know, made this massive success, do you find yourself not as motivated if you're not getting rejected anymore?
Well, here's the thing with Book of Life. As proud as I am of the movie, it didn't do box office-wise what they expected. when we tested the movie, it got a 97, which is insane. So when the movie tested that well, I think the assumption was the movie's going to do a lot better at the box office. Hmm. The problem we had was when we tested the movie, you know, we would ask non-Hispanic people, because it was almost, it didn't matter what Hispanics thought because it was just so positive across the board. But at some point they just said, okay, we know we have that audience. And so when we tested it with non-Hispanic people, one of the things that was a little shocking to me was people would say, did you like the movie? Oh, I loved it. Would you recommend the movie? Absolutely not. What? How could you like the movie but not want to recommend it? And one of the things that a lot of people said was, well, it deals with a subject matter that I don't feel comfortable recommending to another family if they're not ready to talk about death with their kids. Hmm. And so the concept of death, it's still such a negative, it's sort of such a taboo subject that I think it scared a lot of parents. And, you know, unfortunately, if you hear Guillermo del Toro, right, most adults think horror. Right. Right? They don't think that he's produced Kung Fu Panda or Puss in Boots. They basically assume it's a horror thing. Yeah. And especially this is before Pacific Rim. So I think those things scared a lot of the grown-ups. We certainly didn't have any problem with kids wanting to see the movie. Our big problem was parents wanting to take their kids to see them. And then obviously, you know, some of the ethnic stuff we also got. Most depressing cards I got on the testing was, did you like the movie? Absolutely. Would you recommend it? No. Why? Hmm. Because it was made for them. It wasn't made for us. Wow. And that type of stuff, you know, you can't. Like, at least in my lifetime, I hope that goes away. Wow. But this is a cultural shift. Yeah. And so after Book of Life, I kind of became you're the Day of the Dead guy. And so, as you guys know, in Hollywood, you kind of get pigeonholed. Mm-hmm. So everything I got offered was pretty much variations of this. Hmm. So trying to get another original movie going, which they've announced, I'm making a Kung Fu space western, which is my dream film for when I was 13 years old. I love Kung Fu movies. I absolutely adore Westerns. And then I love the, you know, the space operas of the 70s. And I'm sure you guys know which one I'm talking about.
So, of course, just throw them all together, right?
Yeah. And it's something I'm seeing in culture, right? Yeah. I'm seeing it in food truck culture where people are mixing, you know, curry with burritos and Kobe beef tacos. Like, I'm seeing this crazy, beautiful mix of cultures. And so, I truly believe all stories have been told. We're in the remix era. And so I really wanted to take those genres that I so passionately love and then try to tell a story mixing all three. And, you know, it's a big deal for me. It's the first thing I ever do where the main character is not Hispanic. So I have a Caucasian lead. And so for me, it's very exciting and very exotic. And so I'm constantly now, I'm like, white people, they're so complicated. It's one of those things where Guillermo del Toro told, getting your second movie made is even more difficult than getting your first movie made. And he has been prophetic in pretty much everything he's told me. But yeah, there's a lot of pressure.
And it's proven true.
Oh yeah, it's ringing very
so
true.
How else is this new project going?
Oh, it's so far it's going great. I've obviously, you know, Book of Life came out October of last year, and then you kind of, you're like a band. You go on tour promoting the movie. I premiered in Italy 2 months ago. So I just finished promoting the movie. So this whole time I've been designing and writing on the film, but this is, I don't know, the past 2-3 months have been the first time where I get to just solely concentrate on it. And I haven't made any announcements, but it's looking like we found a studio partner that's going to be helping us with it. So I am super excited about this.
Is Guillermo on board for this one?
He said he is very happy to give me advice. You know, he's going to read the script and give me notes. He's going to do voices for it.
Oh, nice.
But he said, as far as producing it, I only produce first-time directors.
He just wants you to pitch again, is what it is. He just wants to.
But you know what? He was really tough on me. And in a way, early on, I had a really hard time sort of saying no to him because I am such a big fan. And I, you know, every time he would talk to me, I would see the Pan's Labyrinth fawn behind him and like all that stuff. So it was really, really difficult for me to disagree with him. And I could tell he was getting upset. And so at one meeting, he gave an idea and everybody in the room was like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. And I said, you know what, Guillermo, I don't think that's a good idea. And I sort of broke it down as to why I thought for this movie, that's not a good idea. And here are the reasons. Here's how I think we can make that work. And he got really excited. And so everybody was like talking, like, rah, 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 rah. And he goes, quiet. And he goes, Jorge, did you hear that? And I was like, what? He said, one of your testicles just dropped. So that was the kind of teacher he was.
Come over here and let me hold you upside down. Draw for me.
So Guillermo is going to advise me as a friend and as a mentor. But as far as a producer, he only produces first-time directors. And I used up my my chance. And as he put it, it's time for you to fly, bird.
Well, man, we really appreciate you coming on and telling these great stories. You know, one of the things about Book of Life, I think, is that sort of struck a chord with me is that it's about, you know, staying true to yourself in the end with Manolo. And it's certainly obvious that you sort of live that to the fullest, you know, to take that much rejection and then to turn it around and to use your own, you know, power of storytelling to sort of convince people of of your vision and persuade them with your passion is a rare thing, I think. So it's really great that you shared this stuff with us and our audience because I think it's very, very inspiring.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. And honestly, thank you for having me as a guest. You know, this is a very noble endeavor that you guys are doing. I think as professional and as artists in our industry, we have to help others. Yeah. I truly believe that that's the only way to get better, and that's the only way that you will succeed. Is if you, of course, you can be a horrible human being and succeed, but that's the anomaly. Right. I think if you help others, others will help you. It's just sort of the human spirit. And I honestly believe that you should try to help those who can't help you, and that will come back to you. And
well,
so if people can learn from all my mistakes, then I put it in a little pebble into the bridge of someone else's success.
Well said.
We'll leave it at that. But yeah, thanks so much for everything. And hopefully we can have you back on to talk about your new project later on as it's going.
Absolutely. You just say when and I'll be here.
Awesome. All right, Jorge. Thanks so much, buddy. Have a good one. Well, Dan, what did you think of those awesome stories about Jorge?
They were awesome stories.
They were.
Yeah. I think, as we kind of alluded to in the very beginning of this episode, we had a chance to hear some of those same stories. But, I mean, be completely honest, it's just as good, if not better, the second time around.
Yeah.
When you hear those stories. And it is so inspiring. There's so many times as an artist you just want to give up.
Yeah, I mean, they are inspiring, and it's also sort of proof of how well he is at telling stories. I mean, he gives like all the nice little tidbits that you need, but not too much that you're bored.
It's like you're there with him, the side of Guillermo del Toro's pool, doing the pitch.
right. sweating alongside. Yeah, that was fantastic. Yeah, like I said, I really respect the man for, I mean, to pass up that first initial DreamWorks offer.
Yeah.
$200 million, and he goes, well, this isn't really the movie I want to make. That's a lot of balls, man.
Yeah, and it carried through with the music, too. You know, you get Mumford & Sons like, oh, here's an original song for your movie. Uh-huh. No.
I know. It's like, right.
And that
not a lot of people can do that. It's,
or would,
yeah.
Yeah, it's, they wouldn't do it. They go exactly the way they advised him.
Yeah.
You have an original song by Mumford & Sons. You need to rewrite your story. No, fuck you. I'm not going to rewrite my story.
Yeah.
To do that with all respect, I'm not going to do that.
Which is really interesting. It kind of solidifies. If you remember, we have an article on our blog. If you haven't read it, be sure to do that. We'll put a link in the show notes. Mm-hmm. That kind of goes. We talked to Augusto and Glow and Paul, were the VFX, CG and supervisors and the art director, respectively. To hear kind of how some of the artwork was made.
Yeah.
And almost one of the themes across all three of them was how much or how passionate Jorge was about the movie being made the way that it should be made.
Yeah.
And I think just kind of hearing it directly from Jorge, you can tell why that was the case from the actual production of it as well. You know, it carried all the way through. Because it's not the first time that he's been up against something, you know, a challenge of maybe this can't be made. Yeah, it can. you know, just keep going at it and, you know, tell me why it can't be made because I'm going to figure out a way to work around that.
Yeah, and we hear a lot of, like, supervisors and artists all the time talk about how the greatest thing that they can ever imagine when they walk into a job is to know that the director or whoever it is has a vision exactly what they want, and he's one of those people, right?
Yeah.
But you also got the sense that they were excited that he knew what he wanted, but what he wanted was going to take a lot of work, and it was going to take doing things, thinking outside the box, making things work. Basically, sort of getting everybody else into his mode of creative, of creating things, which is sort of hustling. Right, he's got to go hustle for this money, you know, and talk to people and convince them, or convince them to give him the song, right? And he has to do that to sell this vision to everybody else.
Yeah,
and you could tell that it was a lot of work, but everybody sort of respected him, and were really happy with how it turned out.
Yeah, and after watching the movie, I definitely have to agree. I think it's something that, because it is very different. I don't know if it would have worked if it was that different as far as, you know, just the style of the artistic style and that. But then if there were parts that were compromising on that, you know, with the story, I just don't know if it would have worked in that way.
Mm. Yeah, I remember him talking on, I think it was at SIGGRAPH, he said this, how they changed the movie up a little bit because of some of the testing that they did, and they put a frame narrative around it.
If you remember, in the
beginning, right, you have this busload of little kids who come to the museum, and then they're like,
they're actually telling the story from the story, book,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That wasn't originally in it, from what I understand, but they sort of had the idea that people aren't going to really understand what's going on if you just drop them into the story of wooden puppets and everything looks like a cubist painting or something.
Yeah.
So I guess there were some concessions, but man, overall.
But even in that, he said he pulled that inspiration from Princess Bride, which basically had the same idea, right? Of somebody telling the story. So I think even in his concessions, he still got his way of telling the story the way he wants to tell it.
Yeah. Very inspiring. Mm-hmm. Well, we hope you guys were inspired too. It was a real honor for us to get to talk to him, and hopefully we'll get him back next time and we can talk about that new project.
Yeah, the Kung Fu Space Spaghetti Western.
Oh man.
Oh, can't wait for that. Yeah.
If you've got any questions, comments, suggestions for other episodes, or maybe you just feel enraged and want to yell at us, reach out to us at our email address, pixelhub@pluralsight.com.
Or if you want to tell the world how awesome we are, hop over to iTunes, leave a rating and review that will make us proud. Thanks for listening.